May the 10th, and you have tuned in to the Mike Malloy Show on the Nova M Radio Network. My name's Jeff Farias. This is my fourth day sitting in this week. I'll be here all week and Monday of next week, actually. Mike, Kathy, and Molly are on a family vacation, returning back on the 15th of May to the airwaves. It's you and me tonight, folks. If you want to join this evening's conversation, 1-800-989-1480 is the phone number. We're streaming over at NovaMRadio.com. And podcasts of this program are available at that same website, NovaMRadio.com. I have a website for my show. It's called The Jeff Farias Show. The website is JeffFarias.com. And you can email me, Jeff@JeffFarias.com. Where to start? Lots to talk about tonight. Have a guest coming on at the bottom of this hour. His name is Sasha Abramski. He's written a book called American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment, looking at the American prison system and the changes in it in the last 30 years or so. Should be an interesting discussion with him. And of course, I like to do caller-driven radio, so I take a lot of calls, get through them. Lots of interesting stuff happening in the House of Representatives today. Alberto Gonzalez was there testifying. They passed a bill with regard to funding over there for the war and getting some other, trying to get some benchmarks in place. Michael Moore is being investigated. That was interesting. Vladimir Putin compared the United States to the Nazis in pre-World War II. We find out essentially there was a ninth U.S. attorney fired. Giuliani's firm was trying to influence the DEA with regards to the drug company that makes OxyContin that just paid this huge multi-million-dollar fine. And there's also further evidence that the White House has been protecting emails made by Karl Rove with regard to the attorney firings. I have lots of audio from the various House members questioning Alberto Gonzalez, and I assure you it was not nearly as, as polite as his trip to the Senate. The House members roughed him up a little bit more than they did over in the Senate, if that's believable. And we also had some really interesting testimony on the floor of the House. I got this fellow, Representative Doggett from Texas. I want to play a piece of audio from him. And, of course, Bush went to the Pentagon this morning and spoke as well. And I have some audio from that. But first off, let me give you Representative Doggett, Democrat from Texas. This is but just about a minute and a half long, and maybe I'll take a few phone calls. But this is a continuing series of Democrats doing good, speaking up, and hitting the nail on the head. I think it's important that we tip our hats when they get it right. Hear this one.
Year five of blunders, that is a true slow bleed policy in Iraq. Defeatism? Well, that is an administration that lacks the courage to admit its failures and which pays for those failures with the blood of the brave, the blood of someone else, and with $10 billion of your tax money every single month. Gimmicks are what got us into Iraq in the first place. It certainly wasn't the war on terrorism. You can make all the excuses that you want for continuing to embed our troops in a civil war, but a vote today for the Iraq Redeployment Act is a vote to end endless war. It is a vote for a fully funded safe and orderly redeployment that allows us to refocus on the war on terrorism, which is a threat to our families, rather than the civil war in Iraq, which is not. It is not the enemy that has us pinned down in Iraq today. It is this administration's unwillingness to admit its mistakes and its lies. The intervention in Iraq was this country's largest foreign policy blunder. Now it's time for Congress to intervene. With this war in its fifth year, for Congress not to act now is for Congress to become an enabler and an accomplice to the administration's errors. Vice President Cheney rightly complains about the Iraqis proposing to take a two-month vacation. But what is really at fault here is Mr. Cheney and this administration's four-year vacation from reality. Victory is improving our family's security, pursuing policies contrary to that objective, committing the same error over and over again. That's defeatist.
Ah, that was wonderful. I loved this particular line.
It is not the enemy that has us pinned down in Iraq today. It is this administration's unwillingness to admit its mistakes and its lies.
Have you heard a more succinct point as to the struggle we're facing in Iraq now? It is not the enemy that we have to worry about in Iraq. It is the administration that is the problem with Iraq. Let's go to James in Chandler. You're on the air, James.
Hi. Some great comments. You know, I was thinking about what's going on with this war funding bill.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're continually being clubbed over the head with is got to support the troops, which, you know, everybody that's listening to what Bush is doing knows that that's really the furthest from the truth.
Right.
But what I was thinking is here we've got this great big bill that's got all these things tied to it. It's got funding for the VA. It's got body armor. It's got troop readiness things all tied
mm-hmm.
to it.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we break those things out? So send up a bill that has nothing but here's $1 billion for the VA. And, you know, if he says, oh, he supports troops, then he'll sign it.
Yep.
And then we send another one for here's body armor for the troops. And, you know, if he supports the troops, he signs it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we start to get to things like, troops have everything ready. They have to be fully ready to deploy before they can go over to Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a bill that, he doesn't want to sign that because it's going to tie his hands.
Right.
So now, okay. You know,
but then he has to come out publicly say he wants to send troops over who haven't been properly trained and prepared.
Take this support the troops club away from him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like now you've got a track record from from Congress saying, look, here, you're saying we don't support troops here. We did this, and we did this, and then we did this, and you are the one that didn't want to do it. And
right.
then you end up whittling down the bill to be nothing but, you know, now what's left is a war bill. So now we're supporting the troops, and you just want your war.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's a great idea. A series of quote-unquote clean bills, as they like to say, with nothing attached to it. Address each specific issue separately in the bill and let him react to them. Let him, because he can't confuse them. He can't, change the issue, change the subject like he's doing on all of these, trying to bring up all the pork spending and all this unnecessary spending, as he likes to call it, when it's actually VA funding, which he considers the unnecessary spending. And make them, that's a great idea, James. I don't know why our representatives aren't doing that.
The Republicans could come up and throw up a bill for some core brain dead person in Florida, and they'll make him sign that.
Right. Yeah.
He'll kind of sign that. But now, you know, what about this other stuff? The other thing is if it does look like, you know, if he wants to veto the troop readiness bill
mm-hmm.
or something like that,
mm-hmm.
then okay. Well, I've got to believe that you've got the power to override that veto, and because what representatives are going to say, oh yeah, we want to send the troops into battle unready.
Right.
So you do all that, and then you make a big deal about each individual step. Like, look here, we're supporting troops. If he wants to veto it, which he makes these huge deals about the with two bills that he's vetoed,
yep.
then that just brings more attention that he's the one that's not supporting the truth.
Excellent point, James. Excellent point, man. I urge you to, out in Chandler, your congressman's not going to help you much, but I urge you
to. Yeah, he's not going to do anything.
Send an email to Pelosi and make that suggestion saying, why aren't we just taking these things on one at a time and force them to address these specific issues rather
yeah,
than lumping
no
them together?
Ambiguity.
Yeah,
it's like,
great idea.
You do it or don't.
Yep, great idea, James. Hey, thanks, buddy. I got to take a break.
Thanks.
We'll be right back after these messages with more of your phone calls. Sasha Abramski will join us at the bottom of the hour. Lots to talk about today. Got a lot of audio to share with you as well, so stick around.
We were young together. We were on the ball. We did not believe in the writing on the wall. We did our best work in the dark. We did our thinking on the run. Would hang together, or they'd hang us one by one. Names were gone like footprints, whisper on
for me. Hey.
I've been one of these people that get endlessly polled.
The clip stopped there. I have to finish that a little bit later.
Last fall, late fall, I've been one of these people that get endlessly polled.
It keeps sticking. I can't get the whole. I'll have to play the whole clip for you later on. Let's go to Rick in Peoria. You're on the air.
Hey, is it Jeff?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Jeff. I wasn't sure if you were there this evening. Thanks. Just real quick, and it's a sarcastic comment. I'm a bit of a sarcastic person. I'm 52 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I traveled the country a lot until I settled down here in beautiful Peoria, Arizona. And I missed the fascist factory is what I'm trying to say as I drove through the country, meaning when I was a kid, I was born in 55, people just were just decent to each other. They didn't want to know what was going on next door, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Etc. The other thing I wanted is, so there's a comment, and I'm not talking about sexuality or anything. People were just, they just weren't like this.
Right.
There was some racism. I was probably 65. I was 12 or 13 when King and Bobby Kennedy were killed, etc. The other thing I wanted to mention, no particular question or anything, but I listened to some of Randy Rhoads' excerpts from Gonzalez today.
Mm-hmm.
And would someone please indict this gentleman for perjury?
Right.
I know you guys were speaking of impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
And I know I'm just so sick of this. I'm just so tired.
Well,
and I'm so disappointed.
Gonzalez also contradicted the White House today. Basically, he said that Bush was part of some meetings, that the White House has denied Bush was ever involved in any of the meetings that were about the firings.
Well, you know, I didn't hear that on the excerpt.
Yeah.
But it's kind of a plea in a way. At 52, can someone do something about these people that have lived through Watergate? These people are just a bunch of criminals. And
yeah.
It's a general phrase, I realize, but some of these specific people are a bunch of criminals.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Rick. Good talking
Keep
to you.
Keep it up, man.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jack in San Diego. Jack, welcome.
Yes. You know, one of the great tragedies of the Bush administration is the number of generals that have retired early.
Mm-hmm.
We may have lost some of our very best generals,
yep.
and many of them retired early because they could not serve under this commander-in-chief, and they wanted a platform to protest his policies. And I used to keep track of all these generals, and there's been so many that I've lost my list of all the different names.
Right.
That's well over a dozen, but this week alone, we've got General Batiste and General Eaton and General Clark not only coming out against President Bush, but making commercials for TV.
Right, with VoteVets.org, yeah.
And last week, or the week before, I think, in a response to his Saturday radio address, it was General Odom.
Mm-hmm.
But evidently, General Batiste has been fired by CBS as their, war analyst. And so he was interviewed by Keith Olbermann.
Mm-hmm.
And I really, of all the generals, this general is really outraged. And I think he's taking it personal that he sees that this commander-in-chief is putting our troops at risk needlessly.
Right.
He wants it to stop, and he wants it to stop now. And so it started me to thinking by some of his language, and if you read between the lines, is I'm just wondering how close this president is coming to a military coup d'etat. And I was just curious what your listeners, what their reaction would be to such an event.
Yeah, I don't think I don't know if that's necessarily possible with the way our government is set up. They would have to basically sort of assassinate the president. I mean, there's a whole chain of command.
Well, not necessarily.
So they'd have to take out the president,
the
vice president, the speaker of the House, on down the list. I think it's like six deep is the list. So.
Did you ever see the movie 7 Days in May?
I'm not sure if I have, actually.
Yeah, that was actually the scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Only in the movie it was foiled at the last minute.
Right.
But there certainly is enough dissatisfied generals, and General Batiste was saying that the people that are active duty are doing all that they can do.
Right.
And I kind of read between the lines that, maybe that is a possibility. And I was just curious what your listeners might think if that event should occur.
Yeah, well, we'll throw that out there, Jack. Thanks for the thought. Appreciate it. We'll be right back with more of the Mike Malloy Show on the Novem Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farias, filling in all week long. Sasha Abramski will be with us when we get back. Mike Malloy Show right here on the Nova M Radio Network. My name is Jeff Farias, filling in for Mr. Malloy all week long, joined by a very special guest by telephone. Sasha Abramski joins us. He's an author. His most recent book is called American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. Sasha, welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening. Thanks for having me on.
I'd like to talk a little bit. Let's just start off. Let's talk about a little bit of numbers. Let's put this in context. How many Americans are currently incarcerated in this country, and where does that rank us in the world?
Well, that's easy. 2.2 million Americans live behind bars, and we're ranked number one. We have absolutely no competitors at this point. We're far and away the biggest incarcerator on earth.
Wow, and. Is that a number that's gone up rapidly in the last 20, 30 years? Or
absolutely. If you sort of rewind the clock and go back to the early 1970s, we had about the same incarceration rate. That's the number of people per 100,000 of the population.
Mm-hmm.
We had about the same incarceration rate as most West European countries, as Canada, Japan, and most other countries that we consider to be our peer nations.
Mm-hmm.
And the countries that had really high incarceration rates back then were the really authoritarian ones, the communist countries of the Eastern Europe and Soviet era, apartheid South Africa, China, and a handful of other countries. And what's happened since then is most of the industrial democracies have kept their incarceration rate roughly constant.
Mm-hmm.
The countries of the ex-Soviet Union have begun dismantling their gulag. Apartheid-era South Africa no longer exists, and so its prison system isn't as large as it used to be. And America has gone off on this tear where each year for the last 35 years, year in, year out, regardless of the surrounding crime rate, it's incarcerated more people. And it's done so enormously that over the last 30 years, our imprisoned population has quintupled.
Wow. Amazing. Now, obviously, you know, we hear about privatized prisons. It's actually become much more of a business, the prison game. How big a business is this nationwide?
It's a part of the whole picture. It's, mm-hmm. It's by no means the driving force for mass incarceration, but certainly there are a couple hundred thousand people, give or take, who now live in private prisons.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a number of companies that are publicly traded that now have a very large profit motive in keeping the prison population high and keeping new prisoners coming in. And obviously, when you create that profit motive, you create a series of incentives to interfere with public policy. So instead of making good public policy, you try and craft public policy that will end up having a desired end result for your shareholders. And in this case, that means we'll end up having more prisons. And Arizona actually is one of the states where there's been this drive towards private incarceration facilities.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, it's a big business out here. We hear about it all the time. One of the terms in the book you use is a supermax prison. What exactly is that, and how did that come about?
Well, a supermax prison is literally the highest security prison that humankind can devise.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a prison which is based around the model of permanent lockdown. So you take a group of prisoners, a few hundred prisoners, and you put them in these self-contained pods. Each pod might have 8 to 10 cells. And within those pods, each prisoner is going to live in a 6 by 8 foot cell 23 hours out of the 24 a day. They're going to come out for 1 hour a day for exercise, and oftentimes it will be exercise in a private fenced-in yard.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to eat in their cells. The guards will just sort of push in a food tray through a mail slot in their door. They're going to have no face-to-face visits with their family members. They're going to have visits basically through plexiglass windows. And the purpose of the supermax is to control, quote-unquote, the worst of the worst. They came out about 30 years ago, and ever since then, they've been really, really big business. They cost about $250 million to bring one supermax prison online.
Wow.
So if you think of multiplying that around the country, tens of billions of dollars now being invested in these very, very high-end, hyper-monitored, hyper-surveillance-based prisons, where there's absolutely no attempt to rehabilitate inmates. It's all about containment. It's all about control. Of course, the problem is, even in the high-end prisons, most of the people, when they're sent to prison, are going to come out of prison.
Mm-hmm, right.
And they come out having been utterly brutalized by these conditions.
Wow. Amazing. Now, you mentioned Arizona, and obviously it's a big business here. We know California has a lot of people incarcerated, and it's also a big business over there. Are there any differences regionally around the country in terms of prison culture and the way prisoners are different? Say, is there a difference between, say, the way prisoners in the Deep South are treated versus...
Absolutely. One of the things I try and do in my book is I delve into the history of the correctional system, because one of the things I think that needs to be explained here is prisons didn't start off as a reactionary institution. Prisons in America actually started off as an Enlightenment-era alternative to the death penalty and to corporal punishment.
Mm-hmm.
And when the first prisons were built in Philadelphia and in New York, they were built almost exclusively with rehabilitation in mind. And with hindsight, we can say some of the techniques they used were crazy. They isolated people. They enforced rigid silence. They made people work on handcrafted trades in isolation in their cells. And they didn't do a very good job of rehabilitating people, but the intent was there.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Quaker experiment, and the intent was very much to remodel the character of the criminal classes. Now, in the South especially, that rehabilitation model never took root. You had in the 19th century something called prisoner leasing, which was basically a modified version of slavery. And what would happen is, just after the Civil War, the state would sweep up a lot of low-end offenders, oftentimes vagrants, many times landless ex-slaves. They'd put them into their criminal justice system. And instead of building prisons, they would literally lease these people out to private industry. And they would lease them out using the terminology of slavery. They would call them full hands, mm-hmm. medium hands, and dead hands. And then they would be worked oftentimes into their grave by the mining companies and the railway companies and the farmers to whom they'd been leased out to. And if they tried to escape, they were shot at or they were whipped. There were some investigative journalists about 120 years ago who did these exposés on southern penitentiaries. And they found that in some systems, more than 1 in 10 prisoners in any given year would die. So these were basically America's version of the Siberian prison camps of the Russian system. The South historically, even if you go forward into the 1960s, you see stories about southern prison culture where the prison guards are carrying shotguns, riding horses, and lording it over chained inmates working in the fields.
Right.
You also routinely see stories of prison wardens whipping their inmates with leather straps. That was an official accepted part of southern penal practice into the recent past. Now, if we come forward to today, it's a little bit more complicated. There are some very well-run prisons in the South. I mean, in many instances, there are some lousy prisons, but there are some good prisons in the South. And by extension, there's some very bad prisons in places like California or New York or Nebraska or a whole host of other non-southern parts of the country. So I'd say there are regional differences, but there's definitely crossover between the southern and the non-southern criminal justice culture at this point.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned initially, as part of the Enlightenment culture, the whole notion of prison was about rehabilitation, was about turning people around while they're incarcerated. That doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Rehabilitation doesn't seem to be as much a goal. Is that an accurate assessment?
I think it is. And actually, that was very much what I was trying to convey in my reporting. The more I reported this and the more I thought about it and studied it, I almost came to think of criminal justice systems, A, as a lens on a broader society,
right.
how a criminal justice system treats its inmates and treats the people cycling through its institutions, in large part, says something about the broader social morality.
Well, was that a Tocqueville quote? I think at one point he said you can judge a civilization
by... It was a Winston Churchill quote. And Winston Churchill, your listeners will realize I'm from England originally. And Winston Churchill has always been one of my heroes. And he's always been one of my heroes, not least because he's very hard to categorize politically. He's conservative on some issues. He's very liberal on other issues.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the common threads is he was... usually a humanitarian. And one of the things that he said when he was a young man, when he was the Home Secretary in England about 105 years ago, I think, he made this comment that one of the best ways to measure the values of a civilization was to measure the way that it treated its prisoners.
Right.
And the implication of this was that no matter your politics, whether you were conservative, whether you were liberal, if you wanted to be considered humane, there were certain basic things you had to do for prisoners because they were the least powerful people in society. They were the ones who'd had their freedom stripped away from them. They'd been told that because of what they'd done, they'd lost most of their political rights and their civil rights. They were locked up out of sight, and they were under the control of guards who'd been given this extraordinary level of power. And Churchill's concern was if the guards began to abuse that power, and if the people who employed the guards tolerated that abuse of power, you'd rapidly have to slide towards a much crueler, much more sadistic kind of society.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's as true today as it was 100 years ago. One of the things that in my book I try and talk about is this idea that crime is more than just about crime and punishment is more than just about punishment. And what I mean by that is in some way this is a very mythological area of human life. The things that we fear as a society and as individuals and the responses that we put in place to try and deal with those fears, they speak to very deep things about what we are as human beings. And the title of my book, I call it American Furies, and it's a play on the ancient Greek myth of the three goddesses. They were called Erinyes in ancient Greek, and that translates to the Furies.
Mm-hmm.
And the three goddesses were people who were goddesses who were conjured up by crime victims, and their purpose was to chase criminals around the Mediterranean world and into their graves. They were designed to terrify malfeasance into their graves.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of think that in a more secular way today, America's prison system is fulfilling that function, that we've become so scared of crime and drugs and social disorder that we've put in place this very, very rigid set of institutional responses. And in many cases, those institutional responses do a tremendous amount of damage to the broader society.
Excellent point. Hey, we're going to take a break. I got to go to a commercial break. We're here with Sasha Abramski, American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. Fascinating book. Lots more with Sasha when we get back. Stick around.
There's a cab across the street, supposed to be protecting me, storing every little file. Make a promise and take a while. Hooked up to a satellite, make sure the world's behaving right. I don't mean to bust your groove, think it's time we made a move. Freedom isn't free tonight.
He's in the jailhouse now.
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 I told him once or twice to quit playing cards and shooting dice. He's in the jailhouse now.
Hey, we're back. The Mike Malloy Show on the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farias, joined by Sasha Abramski, author of American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. A great deal of the book looks at our evolving attitudes about imprisonment and crime. I found this interesting, and I'll throw this question out to you. Who gets a stiffer prison sentence? Top Nazi commander found guilty of war crimes at Nuremberg, or a three-time drug offender in America present day?
Well, amazingly, it's the three-time drug offender. And when you're trying to understand what's happened to American society, and more particularly the American prison system in the last three decades, you always come back to the elephant in the room, and the elephant in the room is drugs. And the reason I say that is not because we're using drugs more than we were in the past. It's because we're dealing with drug use more harshly and more unimaginatively than we were in the past and than other countries do today. So when I was doing my research, I thought, well, let's take a look and see what happened to the top Nazi defendants at the Nuremberg war crimes trials. And I knew that some of them, the very top tier, had been executed. They'd been hanged after the trials. But I also knew that many of the others, including some very senior Nazis, had received finite prison sentences. And so I did a bit of research, and I found that almost all of the top Nazis who weren't executed received prison sentences of less than 20 years. And even the ones who received more than 20 years were later let out early. So by the 1960s, almost all of the top Nazis who had been sent through the prison system were back on the streets.
Wow.
And this included a man called Albert Speer, who was Hitler's chief confidant. And this man was about as close to the center of the Third Reich as possible. And he got a 20-year prison sentence. And that wasn't because the prosecution was being lenient or the judge was being lenient. It was because at the time, 20 years was thought to be an unfathomably long sentence, and giving somebody 20 years was in the strongest way possible saying your actions are so far beyond the pale that we think you deserve to have this huge part of your life taken away from you. Now, I started thinking about it, and the more I thought about it, the more this seemed to me important, because today, if you go around the country, if you look at the prison system in California, in Alabama, Louisiana, and so on, you can find numerous men and women, middle-aged men and women, who when they were in their early 20s were convicted of drug crimes. And we're not talking about kingpin drug crimes. We're talking about low-end drug dealing, low-end drug smuggling crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And they were bad, you know, they did bad things, and they should have got some time in prison, and they certainly should have been mandated into drug treatment programs. But instead, they were often given decades behind bars. And so you routinely, over the last 10 years, I've gone around the country interviewing people inside prisons and outside prisons about the war on drugs. And you routinely find middle-aged men in prisons like Angola in Louisiana or St. Clair in Alabama who are serving to all intents and purposes life sentences for nonviolent drug crimes.
Wow.
In Angola prison alone in Louisiana, there's a couple hundred men serving life sentences for heroin crimes dating back to the 1970s. And to my mind, that's extraordinary that we're handing out sentences like candy that are longer than the sentences our grandparents' generation gave to the top Nazis. It seems to me there's a fundamental disequilibrium here.
Right, and you hear dissent from many judges in a lot of these drug cases because a lot of these sentences they're giving out are mandatory. Their hands are tied. They're not allowed to use their own discretion in these situations.
That's right. It comes back, actually, to a much broader critique of the political process. Mm-hmm. But soundbite politics plays out in this very sort of simplistic hard versus soft way.
Right.
And in the world of soundbite politics, especially around crime and punishment, it's very, very easy to gain cheap points by, quote-unquote, out-toughing your opponent. And the way you out-tough your opponent in 15 seconds isn't to put in place complicated policy solutions to a problem like drugs. It's to say something simple like three strikes and you're out,
right,
or you do the crime, you do the time, something that's easy to stick in the mind of an audience. And one of the things that has increasingly frustrated me as I've reported this is the conservative stranglehold on the language. Now, there's been a lot of talk in the last few years about morals, and the conservatives have sort of staked out a claim to the morals vote in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been absurd, this idea that conservatives have a monopoly on moral values. And I think the same is true for criminal justice. The conservatives in the country proposing laws like three strikes and you're out have claimed a monopoly on tough on crime politics. And again, it's absurd because nobody in the political system, whether they're liberal, progressive, conservative, nobody wants to be lenient on crime. Nobody wants a society bedeviled by crime.
Mm-hmm.
But just because you don't want a society bedeviled by crime doesn't mean you have to leap into bed with the three strikes and you're out crowd. And I think the more I've researched this, to be genuinely tough on crime, you have to put in place policies that will deal with crime. Both deal with it before it occurs and then sensibly deal with criminals after it occurs. And that means you have to invest in things like drug treatment programs.
Mm-hmm.
You have to invest in treatment for the mentally ill because 500,000 people inside prison are seriously mentally ill.
Hey, can I bring you back for one more segment?
Absolutely.
Time for me? Because I'd like to touch onto that subject. Three growing segments of our population in prisons: women, juveniles, and the mentally ill. When we get back with Sasha Abramski, right here on the Mike Malloy Show, Novam Radio. We'll be right back. Back. It's the Mike Malloy Show on the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farias. Joining me by telephone, Sasha Abramski, author of American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. Sasha, before we went to break, we were talking a little bit about so many of mentally ill inmates out there. Now, you did you researched and did a report with Human Rights Watch about the hundreds of thousands of mentally ill inmates out there. What did you find?
What you find is something extraordinary. Basically, about 30 to 40 years ago, we began deinstitutionalizing the mentally ill, taking them out of mental hospitals and closing the hospitals down. And the intent, at least the explicit intent, was that you could use the money and create a much more humane community-based network of mental health facilities. So instead of locking people up, you would treat them in the community and they'd be functional in the community. What ended up happening is the hospitals were closed down, and that pot of money began to be raided by politicians who wanted to fund other projects. And this was a group which didn't really have a strong political constituency or a strong political voice. And so the network of promised community mental health facilities never materialized. And more mentally ill people just began falling through the cracks. They'd go unmedicated. They would go untreated until they committed a crime or otherwise came to the notice of the police. And then they'd get arrested. And instead of going through a treatment process, they'd start going through the criminal justice system. And some of these people were very violent and under any conceivable system of justice would eventually have ended up in prison. Many of them weren't violent. They were basically nuisances and they were misfits and they were the urban poor who we see living on the streets. Many of them maybe are the people you see talking to themselves and so on. They weren't necessarily violent, but they got put into the prison system. And once in the prison system, because they were mentally ill, they found it really, really hard to obey the prison rules.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't obey the prison rules in prison, you go before an administrative board, and you get punished. And the default mechanism of punishment is you get sent into a secure housing unit, which is basically a mini supermax within the prison. It's an isolation unit for the hard-to-control prisoners. So what I ended up finding for this Human Rights Watch report is, by conservative reckonings, by the most conservative way of calculating it, there's about 400,000 to 500,000 seriously mentally ill people inside prisons today, or prisons and jails. And many of them are in the worst possible environment for a mentally ill person. They're in an isolated, locked-down environment. They're not interacting in any meaningful way with counselors or with psychologists. They're not given their medications, or if they are given their medications, they're often given the wrong kinds of medications. And so you hear these absolute horror stories. You hear horror stories of mentally ill people self-mutilating, just really intensely disturbing stories of people gouging their own eyes out, even in some cases, cutting at their arms, inserting staples and pens and any other object they can find into their bodies. And it's an accepted and understood part of prison life that this is going to happen in the high-security units of prison. Mentally ill people are going to do really disturbing things, both to their own bodies and to their surroundings. And in my book, I describe it as a modern-day bedlam, that basically we've given up on the notion of treating these people, or we've put them into an environment where treatment is almost guaranteed to be ineffective. And the result is, when you go to some of these units, you feel like you're stepping back in time. You hear grown men just howling and screaming, or you see women howling and screaming. You hear this cacophony, this endless noise of disturbed people screaming at the environment they've been put into. Of all the reporting I've done on prisons, and I've been into many, many facilities around the country over the years, I found reporting on the mentally ill in prison to be the most disturbing, because it was so clearly the most inappropriate response for this group of inmates.
Wow. It just sounds harrowing. My God. One of the other people who are finding themselves in our prisons are more and more juveniles are being put in adult prisons. What kind of effect is that having?
Well, it's part of a broader package, the quote-unquote toughening up of the criminal justice system. What basically happened was, about 15 years ago, there were a series of high-profile teen crimes in states like Florida and a few other states, California and so on. And it really scared people. And there was this fear of what was called a super predator generation emerging, a generation of gangsters, of very highly armed, gun-toting, ruthless teenagers.
Wilding was a term. I lived in New York City in the 80s, and that was
absolutely
a big fear. Yeah.
That's right. Wilding referred to this case in Central Park where a woman jogger was attacked and brutally attacked, ostensibly by a group of young teenagers. Actually, a couple of years ago, it turned out that many of those confessions were false, and men, they were now grown men, were released from prison. But the term wilding did enter the culture, and it was basically the notion of a sort of unredeemable teenage criminal. And what began happening was politicians started to look for a way to deal with this that would satisfy a scared electorate. And one of the solutions they hit upon was to move an increasing number of teenagers out of the juvenile system, which was perceived to be soft, and into the adult system, which was perceived to be tougher. And so in states like Florida in the 1990s, you start seeing thousands and thousands of teenagers cycling through adult courts and then cycling into adult jails and prisons. Now, in some cases, those prisons might have been more appropriate places, but in many cases, all it meant was these teenage criminals who might have had a chance at rehabilitation were put into an environment where they were surrounded by hardened adult criminals. They only had minimal access to education and so on. And any chance they could have had of rehabilitation basically went by the wayside. So I think it's a really good example, again, of soundbite politics shooting good public policy in the foot.
Now, you also talk in the book about how women are a fastest-growing segment of prison populations, and you've actually done some research right out here in our own Maricopa County here in Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell your listeners my experience in Maricopa. I went because your sheriff is known to be, quote-unquote, the toughest sheriff in America.
Yeah, it's a self-imposed title.
It's a self-imposed title. His name's Joe Arpaio, and he's very, very good at cultivating a media image of being this no-nonsense tough sheriff. And he's elected. He's been elected every time he's run for office as sheriff since the early 90s. And he claims that he's dealing with the worst of the worst. And because he's dealing with the worst of the worst, he claims he's justified in putting in place a series of humiliation rituals.
Mm-hmm.
So in one case, he made his male inmates parade in fluorescent pink underwear.
Right.
He houses his inmates in these Korean War-era army surplus tents in the desert. So it's very hot in the summer. It's very cold in the winter.
Tent City, it's called. Yeah.
It's called Tent City, and it's literally the sprawling city inside the jail grounds where thousands of inmates live on cots. He's reduced the number of meals a day that his inmates can have, and he boasts that it costs more to feed a cat than it does to feed his inmates. So he's done these series of things designed to prove his tough credentials. And when I was there, he was marketing the fact that he put a female chain gang to work, and Ohio is full of bombast. So he told me gleefully it was the first female chain gang in the history of the world. And the day I was there, I followed this chain gang. It was a group of young women, and they get up at 5 in the morning, and they parade downstairs, and they're chained at the ankles, and they're then shuffled out to this bus, which is emblazoned with gold letters, Sheriff's Chain Gang at Work, so everyone can see it. And then they go out into the countryside, into the desert outside Phoenix, and they went to a pauper's cemetery, and it's on the edge of an Air Force jet test range. And it's fiercely hot the day I was there. It was about 100 degrees by 8 in the morning. And they shuffle off their bus in their chains, and they're allowed about 30 seconds each to go to the portable toilet. They can't even close the door because the chain is snaking out from the toilet to the next inmate. And then they're marched around the cemetery with shotgun-wielding officers marching them around. And they come to these graves that have been dug by an automated machine. And over the next several hours, they had to winch in these extremely heavy chipboard coffins which contained paupers' bodies. And it was an utterly meaningless job because this was a job that could have been done. The machines could have lowered these coffins into the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, these women who were chained at the ankle were lowering these coffins down. And it was utterly soul-destroying, both to watch and also, I imagine, for the women involved. And Arpaio boasted to me that he was doing this because these were the worst of the worst. And again, when you think about that, on the surface, it sounds good. If these really are bad people, why not humiliate them? But if they were really bad people and they'd been convicted of really bad crimes, they wouldn't be in a county jail. They'd be in a high-security state prison.
Right.
So it turns out that Arpaio's inmates, the ones who have been convicted and who are eligible for his chain gang and other rituals, the ones who have been convicted are the lowest-end criminals. They're the ones who were convicted of misdemeanors or what's called Class D felonies. So basically they're people who violated probation. They might have been in possession of drugs. They might have done very, very low-end welfare fraud, maybe a couple hundred dollars of welfare fraud. And these are the ones who Arpaio is claiming are the worst of the worst, and he's putting them to work for the good of society. And it was amazing to me that a group of young women who basically are misfits and nuisances rather than dangerous inmates could be humiliated in this way. And more amazingly to me was the idea that Arpaio thought that this was an electoral key to success, that in doing this he could prove his bona fides to his electorate and therefore continue to get elected. But coming back to your question about why are women such a growing part of the prison population, again, you've got to look that elephant in the room. Look at the elephant in the room. It's all about drugs.
Right.
Most women who go to prison don't go to prison for murder. They don't go to prison for carjacking or any of these big crimes. Most women who go to prison on very, very minor drug offenses. And because we've chosen to incarcerate as our first-tier strategy against drugs, so we see more and more women ending up behind bars. And one of the side effects of that is we see more and more children whose mothers are behind bars and therefore who don't have a stable family life and don't have anyone to raise them at home. And that's a really big problem because if you create a generation of kids whose mothers are locked up,
mm-hmm.
you're basically condemning that generation to failure down the road.
Right. Amazing. Hey, I want to take. Can you stick around for one more?
Absolutely.
Great. I'm really enjoying this conversation.
Me too.
I have a couple of callers who actually have some questions for you as well. So we'll get to that when we get back. I also want to throw a name out for you. And if you've read his work, maybe we can talk about it on the other side. Michel Foucault. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He wrote a book called Discipline and Punish. Maybe we can discuss that on the other side as well. But we'll get to some of our callers' questions. We'll be right back on the Mike Malloy Show on Novem Radio. Mike Malloy Show on the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farias, filling in for Mike Malloy all week long. Joined by phone, Sasha Abramski, author of American Furies, Crime, Punishment, and Vengeance in the Age of Mass Imprisonment. Sasha, welcome back.
I'm still here.
All right, let's take a phone call here. I got Kurt in Phoenix had a question for you. Kurt, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I got a quick question for you. I don't understand the concept that states use for charging a minor as an adult. It seems to me pretty cut and dry. If you're 14 years old, regardless of the crime, you're a minor, aren't you? I mean, I don't understand the convolution of that logic. Can you explain it to me?
Kurt, it's a really good question, because your question goes to the heart of the purpose of juvenile justice. Basically, the juvenile courts were created at the very tail end of the 19th century and the very beginning of the 20th. And their premise was exactly yours, which is that if you're a teenager below a certain age, you're not fully morally responsible, first of all, and second of all, you're more malleable than an adult, so you're more open to reform and rehabilitation. Now, what's happened is, in the last few years, we've moved away from that notion, and so this idea of adult time for adult crime has come in. And what states have done is they've basically, in most instances, given prosecutors discretion. So with Florida leading the way, what happened was states began passing laws saying for many, many crimes, if you were 14 and above, instead of the default assumption being that you go to juvenile court, now the discretion as to whether or not to try you as an adult would rest not with the judge but with the prosecutor. And, of course, prosecutors decided they could make names for themselves by, in a very high-profile way, taking certain teenagers and moving them into the adult system and sort of making them a poster child for the new policy. So you began to see this sort of, again, the interplay of soundbite politics with criminal justice policy, and it began to lead to the dismantling of juvenile justice infrastructure. And, again, I think in a very bad way, because I think the end result is specialized institutions that grew up to deal with the specialized needs of teenage criminals and teenage delinquents have begun being dismantled in favor of this adult prison warehousing model. And I think we're going to probably have to deal with the consequences of that for many, many decades.
Well, thanks for your call, Kurt.
Sure.
Thank you. Let's go to Marie in Tempe. Marie, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. First of all, I want to thank both of you. You know, you're really speaking truth to power, and I really appreciate it. And you are absolutely right about the crime situation and how the police, you know, the laws, I guess I want to say it this way. The laws are meant, are being used just to beat us upside the head. You know, the Constitution's a very small book, but look at all the laws that we have that are, you know, putting us in our own prisons. And I wanted to speak with you just real briefly. Now, what just happened at Virginia Tech, which the news isn't really reporting, but he was using Prozac. And, you know, I think a lot of what's happened is that we're over-medicated, and then you put on top of that the way the systems, you know, mm-hmm. build up. But I just wanted to know your opinion, you know, what you think.
Well, Marie, I think they're both really interesting points. Let me deal with the first one about the expansion of the number of laws. It's very easy to forget that a criminal justice system is basically the sum of the laws and decisions made by the culture around it. And what we consider to be criminal and how we respond to those actions changes over time. So, for example, if you went back to the 19th century, cocaine would have been legal in this country. And then our concerns about cocaine intensified, and by the early 20th century, cocaine was illegal in this country. Marijuana was legal in this country into the 1930s. Then social mores around marijuana changed,
Sasha,
and it was made illegal.
Got to wrap it up. I only got about 20 seconds.
Okay, so basically, I would say, yes, the laws are being used in new ways and in more inclusive ways to get more people behind bars. Regarding the Virginia Tech one, I think it's a separate issue, and while I'd like to talk about it, I don't think I can in 10 or 15 seconds.
Thanks so much for your time. Sasha Abramski, American Furies is the book. Go get it, folks. It's a great read. Thanks.
late fall had I've been one of these people that get endlessly polled.
From Jamaica to the world, it's just love. It's just love.
Hey, we're back. The Mike Malloy Show right here on the Novem Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farias, sitting in for Mr. Malloy this whole week. 1-800-989 is the phone. 989-1480 is the phone number. I better give you all 10 digits there, or people will be cursing me a blue streak. Let's get right back on the phones. We're caller-driven from here on out. First up in the queue, holding the longest, Joe in Tempe. Joe, you're on the air.
Hey, Jeff, I have no idea what that guy was talking about for 45 minutes.
It was an hour, so I think
he's... Prison, he doesn't want anybody in prison,
no,
he doesn't want jail,
he
doesn't want Sheriff Joe, he doesn't want anything. Maybe we should just let everybody go free.
No, I don't think that's what he was saying. I guess you weren't really paying that close attention,
Well, it's
Joe.
Difficult to pay attention when it's just a liberal up there embarrassing your party. Let me tell you something. You people,
tell me something,
you people
Joe.
Need to not get addicted to this power you have, because today you voted to continue funding the war. Now, didn't you?
Two months, I guess. Is that what they're giving them?
Well, you think the war's hopeless, right?
I think we should get out of there.
Okay.
I think we, yeah.
Okay, hold on.
It's not a war anymore. It's an occupation.
Okay. I think the war's hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
So if you fund two more months, you're basically funding the death of these boys.
I agree with you.
Okay.
I'm not funded. I'm trying to pressure them to get out of there. But there's too many Republicans right now in office, and that's what we need to change. We get those Republicans out of there.
We get a
veto-proof majority, and then we can do what we need to do.
I saw the vote on O'Reilly, and let me tell you,
I didn't know O'Reilly had a vote.
No. They showed the liberal vote, and it was all Democrats voting to give two more months to the war. So,
well, how come the Republicans were voting against the?
We're out of power. We don't mean anything anymore. We were smart.
The veto.
We were smart. We threw the election so you guys could own this stupid war. Look, I agree with you. This war is hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
You hear me?
Yeah. So why aren't you pressuring your precious leaders to get us out of it?
Well, because it's financially very good for the country. But
No. That's the last two words of your sentence were wrong.
What?
It's not good for the country.
Well, it's good for certain people.
Yeah, that's right. It's good for Dick Cheney. It's good for the military-industrial complex. It's good for the people who pay Georgia's way.
Hey, let me ask you this. Let's say, for example, Dick Cheney had been, you know, killed in Iraq when he went to visit. Would you liberals get on the air and celebrate? I really wonder about that.
No, I wouldn't celebrate the death of any American.
Yeah, no. I mean, deep down. Come on.
Deep down, yeah. I don't want to see Dick Cheney killed.
You think
I'd like to see him out of
power.
How
about your listeners?
I think
that'd
be the easy way out. I'd like to see him humiliated publicly and spend a lot of time in prison. I'd like to see him shown videos of all the people, all the innocent people, our soldiers, our Americans who had died at the hands of Dick Cheney. And then after that film was done, I'd like them to see the faces of every Iraqi citizen who has died because of Dick Cheney's greed.
Well,
and war lust.
From this point forward, Jeff, I just want you to understand it is known as the Democratic Liberal War in Iraq.
You can try that,
you
my friend, but it ain't going to happen.
You bought it.
Nah,
you
it's your war, son. It's your war. It really is. This is going to go down in history as George Bush's war. You're stuck with it no matter what Rush Limbaugh tells you, buddy. You ain't getting around that. Stu in Sacramento, you're up.
Hey, well, I'm glad I could follow this guy, that creep. First of all, everybody has to realize how far back this Bush crime family goes.
Mm-hmm.
And I advise them all to go on the web and look at the unauthorized biography of George H.W. Bush, mm-hmm. if they've never read it before, to check that out.
Oh, and actually go back to Prescott Bush, who funded the Nazis. Yeah,
yeah. It's all written about in this unauthorized biography, mm-hmm. in one cohesive timeline from back then.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, I have to speak to the caller before you had this guy on, who was wondering about the coup in this country.
Right.
I can't help but wonder, with all those people amassed in the private army over in Iraq and who knows where else, Jeff, what are they planning to do with these people? You know, I think they realize, with people like Eisenhower, who talked about the military-industrial complex,
mm-hmm.
the Sykes and the CIA realize the real patriots who fight wars would never go for this kind of CIA penetration thing.
Right.
And therefore, they need a private army, because if there's such a thing as a coup here, the military wouldn't support it.
Right.
They need private people. And I think I wouldn't put it past these people. Look at them all in this administration. It's the greatest hits of the worst Republicans of the last 40 years in there right now. How could these people from the Reagan, all these people from Iran-Contra, how could they all be back?
Right.
I thought they were criminals.
Elliot Abrams have a job? Yeah.
I know Bush won, pardoned them, but they're still criminals. What are they doing back? I think this really needs examination. They all got to go. Thanks for being there tonight, and good night.
Thanks, Stu. I appreciate your comments. Bye-bye. Let's go next to Virginia in Alameda, California. Welcome, Virginia. Thanks for holding on.
You're such a sweetheart. I can't believe how much I love you for the speaker you had on.
Well, thank you.
I did a ton of volunteer work, actually, for the California Coalition for Women Prisoners, because mm-hmm. right here where we are in Chowchilla, California, is the highest concentration of women prisoners in the entire world.
Wow.
And you see women in wheelchairs with white hair, and they can't walk. And you see, it's just ludicrous. It is absolutely obscene mm-hmm. what is happening. And why people need to understand why this is, I want all the truth seekers to get their pens and pencils and limber up their knuckles to hit the keyboard. Hit criticalresistance.org. And find out just what this prison industrial complex is doing. It affects you. It affects your representation in Congress, if you could believe it. In the census, they count the prisoners in those bum cow towns where they have those humongous prisons. They count them as residents there.
It influences the census in terms of how many Congress people we have from your state?
Yes, how many Congress people you have, how many dollars you get for your schools. It influences everything. The census influences everything. And all those prisoners are not counted from your community. They're counted at those towns. Those towns get all the clout and all the dollars.
Wow.
So you need to tell your congressman that you want your prisoners represented where they come from and where they're going back to. Because by law, they have to return back to the scene of the crime. And that's where they have to live when they get out. But meanwhile, that district is getting all those dollars and those representatives in Congress. So you know they love it.
Right.
And you know that helps Republicans.
Yeah, and it's a big money business. It's a huge money business,
but even in the state business, you've got to get with books, not bars. Those are the youth organizations fighting. You have to tell your congressman not one more dollar for prisons or jails until you start dealing with the mentally and physically ill and doing something else for rehab for the nonviolent. Absolutely no way. Prison guards, tell your union, if you're in a union, tell those prison guard union people to fight for community rehab services and work there, not in those towns, not in those warehouses, not in those torture chambers out there, because, yes, they torture them. Our prison system throughout California is under federal monitoring because they have killed people with health conditions. They've just let them die. They have maimed them. They cannot believe the medical so-called service. It is just butchery that goes on there. Mm-hmm. You go in there for 2 years for check fraud, you die.
Wow.
You die in there.
Unbelievable.
It's a death sentence. And there is also what else affects you that people don't know about. Institutionalized racism. They must be segregated by race. Now they are coming. If there is a gang anywhere near you, any kind of gang that's ethnically mm-hmm. set up, they are instigating that they continue their war as soon as they get back and bring it to a town near you.
Wow, amazing.
So this is institutionalized, and you have to tell your congressman you do not want institutionalized segregation and racism in the prisons anymore. And finally, they tried to deport our prisoners from California. This is one time the mm-hmm. prisoners' guards helped us. They tried to send them to your state, Alabama, to Wyoming, mm-hmm. to Utah.
Yep, Arizona was building private prisons just to take on some of the California prison population.
Sure.
Hey, give it that website one more time.
It's criticalresistance.org.
All right.
They are the biggest national group to help you out. And mm-hmm. legal services for prisoners with children. Mm-hmm. Look them up on the web. They will help you if you have someone locked up and rotting away.
Mm-hmm.
They'll help you get, to an organization near you that'll help you help your loved ones. And we have to stop letting them be taken so far away from us, because that is the biggest likelihood of recidivism, is a lack of connection with people who will help you in your community.
Thanks so much,
that is
Virginia.
The biggest one. Oh, and on the contractors and the military thing, that was what I was going to call you about.
Uh-huh.
Where I heard this great guy, and I do love you for doing that.
Uh-huh, thank you.
I mean, domestically, come on, let's take care of ourselves. They really want us all in prison, and a debtor's prison is next.
Mm-hmm.
So watch what you owe. But on those contractors, darling, I have tried to find out from my Congress people, all of them, and even, you know, from organizations, what does a mercenary get every month compared to a soldier? They cannot tell me. They cannot tell me. No one can tell me what in that budget
right.
is going to those mercenaries who can walk away with thousands
right.
and thousands at any time.
The last number I saw, because I did a whole show on mercenaries, I think it's roughly about four times what the soldiers' pay is.
So
and that's for officers.
That
and it's more like five or six times
place.
Of the grunts. Yep.
We need to call up our congressman and say, take that all away. If they want to work in, if they want to help this country in this occupation, so-called help this country, let them volunteer.
Yep, yep.
And cut the funding. What the heck are our representatives doing funding this garbage?
I agree. Thanks,
and
Virginia. I got to go. I got the music. I got a break coming up. Thank you so much. Be right back. Hey, we're back. It's the Mike Malloy Show on the NovaM Radio Network. I'm Jeff Ferris, filling in for Mike Malloy all week. And my buddy and I, Sarge, were sitting around watching Leslie Blitzer on the Situation Room this afternoon when he said the following.
An Oscar-winning filmmaker, Michael Moore, is one of the president's fiercest critics. So why is the Bush administration now investigating him? I'm Wolf Blitzer. You're in the Situation Room.
And we both agree that was probably one of the stupidest things we've ever heard Wolf Blitzer say on television. a severe critic of the Bush administration, why is the government investigating him? Well, you could call that abuse of power, or you could call it genius marketing on Michael Moore's part. He's making a film called Sicko about the failures of the American healthcare system. And so what Michael Moore decided to do was take some first responders from Ground Zero, from 9/11 in New York City, and take them down to Cuba to get the kind of health care they were being denied in this country. And, of course, now he's being investigated by the Treasury Department about, Cuba is a sanctioned nation. And so now he's getting a bunch of headlines about a month or so before his movie opens, courtesy of the United States government and Leslie Blitzer on the Situation Room. So, hey, we're caller-driven from here on out, folks. I'll take the calls in the order they come. Any topics on the table, as it always is when I'm behind the mic. David in San Diego, you're up next. Hey, David, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, how you doing?
I was just first-time listener. I just was breaking through the radio channel, and I'm a bail bondsman in San Diego, been one for 7 years, and was listening to your interview with Sasha,
mm-hmm.
and it just struck me when he said he estimated only 500,000 people in the prison system were mentally ill. And that just baffled me, because the majority of people I deal with serious, in serious crime scenarios,
mm-hmm.
have mental issues. Bipolar is a huge one, and that is up and coming, especially with women. And I don't know enough about it. I'm not an expert
mm-hmm.
on it and whatnot. But I go and I talk to the law enforcement, and I talk to the deputies at the jail, and I talk to everyone. And I go, how many people do you think in this jail, how many people do you think are mentally ill? And they're like, everybody. And I know they're cynical and whatnot and whatnot, but I would just have to think in the prison system, it would have to be more than 500,000. It would have to be much, much more, just considering on the microcosm that I, Right, I deal with them.
I guess, I mean, you're getting into sort of definitions of what a serious mental illness is, and I think the people here are talking about the people who should be institutionalized, who are, you know, schizophrenic or who really don't understand, you know, just some basic, you know, ways of functioning.
Yeah,
well, obviously, people with serious emotional problems. Obviously, yeah, you could say pretty much anybody who is almost anybody in the prison system has some sort of emotional issue or mental issues that they're dealing with.
Well, I don't think prison's the place for them. And I'm not an expert. And trust me, I deal with them. A lot of them play the victim role great, but these are people with a real rough life, and it's something I don't understand. And I sweat for them, and it's something I strive to understand. But I just don't think that prison's the life for them, but that's just my opinion. Anyway, thank you.
Thanks, David. Appreciate your contribution tonight. Let's go to my buddy Leonard in Glendale. Leonard, you're on the air.
Hey, Jeff. Good to hear from you. You know that one guy, Joe, they called in saying that this is the Democrat-liberal war. All I know is, you know, Bush is the one who got up there and lied. Bush is the one who used the false evidence.
And they're still lying.
Nigeria. Bush and Cheney are the ones who've used, you know, utilized every dirty trick in the book. William Tenet, you know, he knows that Iraq had nothing to do with the bombings that occurred on 9/11.
Well, you know, both Bush and Cheney are out there yesterday and today saying that our numbers prove that sectarian violence is down in Iraq.
They're liars.
They are absolute liars. You know why they're down? Because they stopped counting car bombings.
Exactly. And, you know, one general said while I was over there, he said that it's like the Pillsbury Stay Puft Marshmallow Man or whatever. You poke him in one area to try to put more forces in, it's just going to pop out somewhere else.
Right.
They know that.
Yeah.
But these people are liars. Today, you know, any soldier that died today is another soldier that died from negligent homicide due to, I'm going to just go out and say this, okay? I know a lot of our Democratic leaders are doing their best to stop this thing. But you know what? They need to stop funding this war.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got a governor here in Arizona, and I don't care if they say it's her personal convictions that she says she's not going to support withdrawing American troops from Iraq, but I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat. You don't get up there as my political leader and basically think you're going to get away with this for your political career. Because you know what? Just like you want to play politics to get more votes down the road, to get a higher political office, because you're too afraid to come out and say, take out American soldiers, knowing every day they're going to die because people like you with influence won't say it. Well, we can play politics, too, because we can remember when she wants to go for president or whatever. I don't care if it's a Republican or a Democrat. John McCain, John Kyle, these people need to be stopped nonviolently. And, you know, I don't care if it's dog catcher. I don't care if it's running for somebody down here in Phoenix, Arizona, for Phoenix City Council. If you ask these people, if they say it's not in my jurisdiction, sorry, you know, it has nothing to do with me. I'm running for dog catcher, whether I support troops staying in Iraq or not. BS, because that's politics. You know what? You're going to support it. I'm not voting for you. That's how we make a difference. Because these people, let me tell you, they will not listen. It's just like that traffic light. When you want to put that traffic light in, it's going to cost them $100,000. It's not how many lives are lost. It's how much you complain and how many votes they're going to lose if they don't put it in. And that's what we need to do. And I know I need to put my action where my mouth is. We've got our city councils across this country. The state of Vermont was a state that came out and said they're going to withdraw. We have Democratic leaders. We've even got a Republican down here who says she wants our troops out of Iraq. Every Democrat in this party should be supporting that. I don't care where they are on it. So anyways, you know, I'm just praying for my fellow soldiers right now. Because every day that goes by, another one dies. It does not need to die. And that is totally, totally bogus BS, you know. So all I can say is I don't know what else we need to do to get our soldiers. I just keep on doing what we're doing. But obviously George Bush doesn't have a soul. Dick Cheney's too busy parading with the Queen of England because obviously she likes his unitary executive theory. That's monarchy. And these people are supporting Bush. They're supporting a monarchist. So I feel better now. Anyways, Joe, just keep up. Jeff, just keep up the good work, and I just hope we can get our soldiers out of Iraq and throw Gonzalez in jail. He's the one who needs to be sitting in jail right along with George Bush for war crimes. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
Thanks, Leonard. Well, you know what? I wish more people had Leonard's passion, more people here in Arizona and around the country were willing to lend their voice to this chorus to stop this war, because that's the only way it's going to happen is if we just demand it stops. We'll be back after these messages.
Yeah. are marching in the mud and cold. And when my pack seems more than I can hold, my love for you renews my might. I'm warm again, my pack is light. It's you, Lily Marlene.
It's yes, you, we are back. Lily. The Mike Malloy Show right here on the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farrier, sitting in for Mike all week long. Again, I was stunned when listening to the Leslie Blitzer show this afternoon to hear this report out of Moscow.
Amid the pomp of Russia's annual Victory Day parade, a stinging Cold War-style attack on the United States. The U.S. wasn't mentioned by name, but in a speech to commemorate the defeat of Nazi Germany, Russian President Vladimir Putin made what analysts say was a blunt reference to current U.S. foreign policy. These new threats, just as under the Third Reich, show the same contempt for human life and the same aspiration to establish an exclusive diktat over the world. The Kremlin's been a vocal critic of the U.S.-led war in Iraq.
So, and he did refer to the Cold War, but in all the years of the Cold War, when our two nations had missiles pointing at us, the Russians never called us Nazis before. My God, and this is a man that, you know, Bush supposedly looked in his deep look in his eyes and saw a good soul or whatever, right? And yeah, we're now Nazis in the eyes of Vladimir Putin. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Phil in San Diego, you're on the air.
Yeah, good evening.
Evening.
Thanks, Jeff, for being so fair and balanced, having Virginia and Leonard and that brain-dead O'Reilly head. It's good to give everybody their peace of mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, Virginia, what she said was spot on about the way the neocons want it. They just want us to be reside in gulags.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just wanted to pass on to everybody to call the Judiciary Committee, the direct number 202-224-5225. That way, because basically, this caging thing is turning out to be hopefully the downfall of all these people, and they'll be put in cages where they belong for being traitors, because they could care less about the rest of the world. All they care about is this thing with the dollar signs.
Yeah.
So senseless, you know. It's like, what good does that do? A better coffin?
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Jeff, and you have a great evening.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for comments tonight. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Next up is Armand in Florida. Armand, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, Jeff. Hi.
How you doing today?
I'm doing fine. I'd like to talk about some subjects with you.
Sure. What you got?
Way back when I used to be, I confess in front of everybody on the radio, I admit at one time when years back I was a Republican.
Mm-hmm.
When they were on the outside, things were going to be ethical and moral. Just once they got into power, you know, you wouldn't have these trade agreements that enslave people around the world and put Americans, honest Americans, out of job and compete them with those slaves, and the health care costs would come down, and education would be affordable, and the market would take over, and Jesus would stand on the pulpit, and every day we could say hi to him, and we'd all be blessed with affordable health care and job security, and Republicans would have parades every day. It was just going to be marvelous, remember?
Yeah.
All they had to do was get in power, remember?
All they had to do was get rid of that pesky government we had, yeah.
Yeah, that big bureaucracy and yeah. all those woman-chasing, beer-drinking,
yep,
guzzling Democrats.
Yep.
Well, as time went on, we got all those Republicans, and then these trade bills come up, and they took their payoffs and lied and started dancing around the issues and distorting it. And then the media got deregulated further and got more consolidated, the power and the spin and the omission of important news. And then the health care costs started going up and getting consolidated, and the jobs started leaving, and you know,
mm-hmm,
they got richer, the Republicans, and you start seeing these fine homes going up, and you wonder how they paid for them, and then you found out they were politicians and such. So, you know, they talk about abortion. remember all the times they said they want to regulate immorality by making abortions illegal, but yet these same Republicans and some Democrats, but mainly Republicans, they don't want to sufficiently regulate the corporations or the evil money behind them that gives those very corporations the power to commit the evil deeds that they do, like the pharmaceutical complex. Look at the bill that went through the Senate with turning the FDA totally over to the control of the pharmaceuticals so they can put all their little puppets in there. And
they don't seem too concerned about abortion anymore. They seem to be willing to get behind, you know, the front runner, Rudy Giuliani, even though he's, you know, donated all kinds of money to Planned Parenthood, apparently, as has Romney's wife as well. So this abortion issue should be interesting how they rally around this issue this time around.
Well, I want to say one other thing, too, and then I'd like to comment about Romney if you want to give me the time, but we're covering a lot of issues here. But
I got a lot of people in the queue, so if you can make it, brief, that'd
remember Bush categorically and all the Republicans and the right-wingers and all this. First off, I want to say all you right-wingers out there that are listening, I know you're lurking out there like Mike says, ask yourself this question. I never did for a long time, but now I do. When have you ever heard right-wingers, Rush, Hannity, how many times do you hear them take out the most egregious people in our society? That's the ones that are billionaires that steal their wealth and buy their wealth.
Yep.
How many times do you hear the right-wingers criticize the rich? They never, rarely do.
Unless it's George Soros. They got plenty of criticism for
but
him.
I want to say
a rich
thing.
Who's willing to give money to the left. That's the worst. Worst nightmare.
Jeff, the one thing I want to close with, because I know you say you don't have a lot of time, but there's a lot about Romney that's going to come out. Wait till you see this.
Yeah.
But anyway, remember Bush and the Republicans and the right wing? It's not about oil. It's not about oil. It's not about oil. Do you hear Bush today? It's coming off of his lips. The truth is finally coming out there, everybody.
Yeah.
The truth is finally, this war is all about private sharing agreements. Bush is doing what his pimps that put him in power want him to do,
and
he wants to colonize all the natural resources of the world, starting out in the Mideast and the oil, and turn it over to his billionaire pimp oil company.
And that's what Cheney was doing
in
Baghdad.
That's what it's all about.
Talking about the oil.
That's what it's all
Thanks,
about.
Thanks, Ivan. Appreciate your call, buddy. Let's go to Rich in San Francisco on a payphone. Rich, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I really want to commend you on speaking about the drug war. It's like shocking for me to hear that. But if you want a change, this talk, right wing, left wing, they're both the vipers of hell right now. These crime families of Bush and Clinton got to go. You need a green guy in there. You need Dennis Kucinich, even though I don't agree on his abortion issue. You need Paul Wellstone, who they killed. Here's what you got to do. The people that buy into this war, the ones who are profiting from it are the ones spewing out all their poison. How in error, all this error that was done on false pretenses, yet they're still promoting it. They're profiting on it.
Yeah, it was mismanaged, but just give us a chance. We'll get it right this time after 4 years, right?
Buy into it would buy used toilet paper. The thing is here, let's get real. This country has been taken over by a satanic drunk and his partner in crime, the coke dealer from Mena, Arkansas. Get it, left-wingers and right-wingers. Stop calling them Christians. I received training that you wouldn't believe. Let me give you one example here. Luke 21:23, these King James lawyers interpreted, which the thousands of blunders in there, that at the end of the world, woe to the pregnant women, Jesus speaking. Because the Greek will omit pronouns. There's no yeneke there, but still. Pregnant to paunch. Yastri is the key word. Yastri, where we get gastrology. It's paunch, belly. It could. How about this interpretation, right-wing scum of hell? How about this? Those who nourish the full in the end days, woe to them. Would it make a difference for a woman with a four-year-old running from nuclear bombs? Not woe to them. They do this all the time. Here's what you got to do. You got to boycott the media. I listen to you guys to pick up on things. I give you credit for what you've done. I'm talking about the corporate papers.
Mm-hmm.
Treat them like toilet paper. I watch about an hour of TV a month.
Wow.
I'm a musician. I write songs. Support Oswald and the Weather Balloon. Listen to me. One more thing.
All right, make it quick.
That they blew away the one good president we had, and you expect these dummies to do anything about this? The Beatles came around. Hey, I like the Beatles, but that these people, these American Idol snakes, and these snakes got to wake up. They're going to get judgment. God bless you.
Thanks, Durant. No shortage of distraction out there for the American public. Hey, we'll be right back after these important messages from our sponsors. Oh, hit the thing.
Last fall, late fall, had I've been one of these people that get endlessly polled.
What you put out, you'd eventually get back in return. I thought success was just a ladder to climb. If it's true, there's a sucker born every minute of the day. I've been born a million times. And if it's true, there's a sucker born every minute, I say. You believe what you might, but I know that P.T. Barnum was right. P.T. Barnum was right.
Hey, we're back to the Mike Malloy Show on the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Farias. Check out my website, jefffarias.com. You can send me an email to jeff at jefffarias.com during the course of the program. Let's get back on the phones. Up next in the queue, Lonnie in Phoenix. Lonnie, welcome to the program.
Hi. I wanted to talk about prisons in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have Arizona prisoners in the Midwest, and they recently made the paper because of some kind of riot.
In Indiana, yeah.
In Indiana. Riot, yeah. Okay. There's a prison in Florence full of Alaskans. Okay.
Wow.
And it's there. Now, the reason I know this is a few years ago, my nephew made a bad decision. He ended up in prison for 2 years on a drunk driving charge, mandatory sentencing.
Mm-hmm.
I went to visit him. What I saw in those prisons were 17-year-old boys who had drunk driving charges, and they were put with the violent prisoners because it was considered violent assault. These young boys were housed with the murderers. In fact, my nephew's first cellmate was a man who did 25 years for murder.
Wow.
Now, he was lucky. He had people visiting him. He's doing okay now. But how many of them aren't? And so it's this whole criminalization of so much. And in terms of Florence, outside of the Alaskan prison, there's this little shop that sells the Alaskan prisoners' artwork and stuff, but you won't find a shop selling Arizona prisoners' artwork.
Wow.
And so it's already happened because I was going to Florence 5 years ago, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And that Alaskan prison was already there. And we have such a large criminal prison population because of our unrealistic laws and mandatory sentencing. I worked in association with CPS for almost 25 years. When mandatory sentencing came for child abuse, we actually got less convictions.
Wow.
So there's, you know, issues on all sides of it, and I understand the grief of people injured or killed by drunk drivers. I understand that. What did they make better? And I'm thinking of this one particular 17-year-old boy I saw in there that is going to do, I think, 20 years to life because he made a bad decision and somebody died. He was a child that made a bad decision that ended up in prison, and he will get out a criminal. Because the 2 years that my nephew was in there, there was no rehabilitation. And when he was leaving, he told me he was glad to get out because they were bringing the white supremacist snitches in to put him in this population because they had to move him out of some other prison.
Wow.
So it's already, we've already exported our population, and we have people in Alaska. Now, how can you, if you're an Arizona and in Indiana, how can you be visited by your family?
Right.
If you're an Alaskan prisoner in Arizona, how can your mama come see you?
Right. Yep.
And I just wanted to speak to that.
Well, thanks, Lonnie. I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right. Well, you have a good evening. And
you
hey,
too.
I love Air America, and that April was my worst month ever.
Well, thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Let's go to Alan in Scottsdale. Alan, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you, Jeff?
Good. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I don't complain. I don't complain. Yeah, you know I'm a technician. I don't care to say what I do, but, you know, because I'm a technician, I get to go everywhere, and I've gone to work in prisons. In Manatee, North Carolina, it's the hometown of Andy Griffin, and I think that's where he got the inspiration for his show. I pulled a service call in the state-of-the-art jail there. I mean, it was state-of-the-art. And I wondered, I said, what, this little town, it, you know, how does it have a prison? And I learned that what happened was they were renting out space for people from other states.
Right.
They'd bring these people from the other state. That's quite a growth business.
It was a profit center. Hey, Alan, can I hold you over?
Sure will.
I'm sorry, I should have just
not a problem.
Rambled. But all right, we'll hold you on to the other segment. I want to hear more about this. We'll be right back. More of the Molloy Show. I'm Jeff Farias. Stick around.
Peace beyond this misery. And angels up above that will fill their hearts with love, or will they cry for all eternity?
Mike Molloy Show on Nova M Radio Network. I am Jeff Farias. We were talking with Alan in Scottsdale, who's had quite a bit of experience in prisons. You know, you said you're in North Carolina, is that right?
Yeah, a city called Manatee.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it was a small town, and I pulled a service call there in this state-of-the-art prison. And what they were doing was getting prisoners from different states. And you have to understand that every bed they filled with a prisoner was, I don't know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year.
Right.
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 Now, if you go back in time, if you go back in time when the states were actually responsible for their own prison system,
mm-hmm.
they had a vested interest to make sure this person was rehabilitated. When they come out, they can go back into society.
Into their own communities, right.
Right. When businesses became involved, everything was profit. There was no impetus to get these people to make them into productive citizens again, because that means a bed's going to be open.
Right.
And I noticed, like some of your calls said, our callers said earlier, those people I saw that were watching television and they were playing card games.
Hmm.
And you can imagine doing that for a couple of years, then they're released on the streets. These people will commit crimes again to get back in, because that's the only way they can get a bed and get food.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of times that is the case. Yeah, criminals get out and they'll do something stupid, you know, just to get back in.
Right, I just wanted to add that because, I mean, I've gone into the prison.
Right.
And I just wanted to say that Joe is such a barfly, I tell you
that. Yeah.
He's our village idiot.
I think it's a benchmark, I love that word, as to how desperate that their side is getting. Obviously, he's hearing this on Limbaugh. Limbaugh and Hannity are now trying to frame this as the Democrats' war. And
He has no original thought. He has no original thoughts. He can't say anything that really makes any sense whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, those who want to critique me for letting him on the air, he did wait a good hour and 20 minutes before we spoke to him. So
I've rewarded
his perseverance by...
He loves us and he wants to be amongst us. Isn't that something?
Yeah, go figure.
Hey, keep up the great work.
Thanks, Alan. Good talking to you, buddy.
Thank you.
Robert in San Francisco, you're on the air.
Yeah, Jeff, I want to talk to you about the duck that walks like a duck, if it quacks like a duck, if it swims like a duck, if it flies like a duck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most people call that a duck. So when the Russians are saying, hey, Americans are behaving like, imperialist fascists like mm-hmm. the Nazis, then you have to take it seriously. And they do have connections with Adolf Hitler, apparently. Prescott Bush and the Boys Union Bank and Brown Harriman Brothers did back Hitler's rise.
Yeah, and it wasn't out of the blue. What the big celebration today was celebrating their defeat of the defeat of the Nazis. And you know, I guess they lost millions and millions of people in Russia during World War II. So it wasn't like he was just pointing a finger and calling us Nazis. This was sort of in context of the day and the celebration when everyone is thinking about that to point to the threat of America as the new Third Reich. It's just chilling.
Well, when we subsidize corporate power, you're winding up with the same scenario in this country.
Right.
I mean, look at you've got corporate subsidies. Here, Cheney was defense secretary under Bush 1, and he went and privatized a lot of the activities in the military to Halliburton, and he has $1 million worth when he's defense secretary under Bush 1.
Right.
5 years later, as CEO of Halliburton, he's worth $65 million. Then he becomes vice president, and of course, all these no big contracts. Now he's vice president. So the head of a corporation has just switched hats and become basically head of the U.S. government, because everybody knows that Bush is just there as a figurehead.
Yeah.
He doesn't have it together. Right. Many people think he's drugged out of his mind most of the time, wears body armor behind closed doors in the White House because he's so scared
mm-hmm.
that somebody out there wants to meet justice out to him for what he did 9/11 and what he's doing around the world.
Yep.
So, by the way, about 9/11, there's enough evidence gathered if a grand jury looks at it, this whole administration is going to go to Guantanamo, and rightly so, because the terrorists, if they are, and we believe that they are the terrorists that did 9/11, everything that they had planned for the people they're taking down there should be done to them.
I'm all behind you on that one, Robert. Thanks for your call.
All right. You got it.
Let's go to my old buddy, Bo, in Phoenix. Bo, how you doing?
Hey, Jeff. What's up?
I haven't spoken to you in a long time.
No, man. I tell you, your new hours are good for listening, but it's kind of hard for me to get to a phone right then.
Right, I hear you.
But you know what? Good to hear you this week.
Thanks.
Your earlier guest had mentioned that marijuana was made illegal in the 30s,
mm-hmm.
and I was wondering why, besides, the release of that movie that was later referred to as Reefer Madness that,
right.
Made marijuana users look like raving maniacs.
Right. Well, a lot of it was they were competing with the lumber industry, the paper business, essentially, because you could make hemp was a much better renewable crop to turn it around to make paper. It had all kinds of industrial uses. And, of course, the people that kind of prop it up today are the Anheuser-Busches and the Coors. And those are the people that Anheuser-Busch donates all kinds of money to the DEA. They helped buy those helicopters back in the 90s, late 80s, early 90s, where they had all those special heat-seeking helicopters trying to find people growing their own weed. A lot of those were donated by the Coors Company and the Anheuser-Busch people.
Oh, like they don't want any competition?
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh. Let me ask you something, Jeff. I'm in between keyboards right now, but even when I get back online, it's unlikely that I was gonna I would download any information about marijuana without, mm-hmm. For fear of the people showing
right.
up at my front door.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of recall General McCafferty, when he was the drug czar, finally admitting that, I guess it's not a gateway drug. Am I right?
I think it was McCaffrey. I know, yeah, that's probably a good one. You know, they did a great documentary on Frontline, I think, about the whole drug war and what it was about. And it was really interesting because they were interviewing these DEA agents who, and they were specifically talking about the county in Indiana where I lived. And this is where this guy was stationed. And he was saying it was just insane. He goes, you know, we've been in this thing for 30 years. And all of a sudden they decided to go after the pot people. He goes, it was just kind of pathetic. He goes, these were the most sort of docile, friendly, easygoing people. He just said, we just felt terrible arresting people. And then they weren't just arresting people. They were like arresting them and taking their homes, taking all their possessions. They're just stripping them of all their rights. And here's a guy who was a 30-year veteran of the DEA saying, this policy is crazy. It just doesn't work. It's just going to fill up our prisons. And sure enough, that's what it's done.
Well, hey, at least we're able to live in a free society where we can drink ourselves into oblivion,
right, right,
as long as that six-pack is taxed. I even think that Senator McCain gets a cut of every can of Budweiser.
His wife's family business, and actually it's his business now because her father passed on and she's the heir to it, is a major liquor distributor here in Arizona. Yeah, any can of Bud Light, any Anheuser-Busch product that you touch in Arizona, you're contributing to McCain's political campaign.
Well, is it unreasonable for me to think that we might never get a legitimate, rational thought about marijuana from him, since there's such a conflict of interest,
right,
there?
Yeah,
I mean, if it's not a gateway drug, then what is it? It's just an alternative.
Right.
It's an alternative to a very lucrative tax base.
Right.
And
I had hoped that as the baby boomers matured and came into power, people who were children of the 60s, a more rational drug policy would take effect in this country. That had been my hope for many years. And when Clinton got in power, they did sort of take down a lot of the money that was going after people trying to grow pot in their basement or whatever. You know, the drug war kind of eased a little bit during the 8 years of Clinton.
I'm afraid to buy a 100-watt bulb.
No kidding. Yeah. That was interesting. There was a little grow store in Indiana. Now, most of the people in this southern Indiana town I live with had a little bit of a southern twang in their voice, went into one of these grow stores. And I worked at a company right near me was setting up a screen printing shop, and they needed these special halogen bulbs to do it. And they sent me in to buy them. And I walked in, and this guy had one of those, you know, from nowhere kind of accents. He was a government plant, basically. He was in there. And I had to pretty much give them all kinds of cross-documentation, the deed, you know, my son's birth certificate. They had to know everything about me before they were going to sell me this light bulb, you know.
You know, I kind of look at marijuana a lot like I look at this war on drugs. Yeah, we got a problem with drugs, just like we got a problem with terror.
Mm-hmm.
But Iraq we had bad intelligence. Just
right.
Like we've got bad intelligence about marijuana. Marijuana is not a window to more drugs, or
right.
WMD, if you will.
Right.
And we need to take a real close look at it if we are going to consider ourselves a free society.
Yeah, you know what? I've avoided taking on that topic so far, but maybe I should do a whole show on that, about the political aspects of it, the health and the legalities of it, and I'll do a whole show on the weed. That might be an interesting program.
Yeah, I got a couple of crosses right outside my house at this intersection,
mm-hmm.
direct results of the consumption of alcohol,
right.
The state-sponsored drug.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not a genius, but anybody who's ever used both alcohol or marijuana has to admit that when it comes to decreased motor skills,
mm-hmm.
there's no comparison.
And aggressive behavior. You don't see a lot of fights among
people
hanging out at a Dead concert. Thanks,
I hear
Bo.
The music.
Thanks,
Take
Bo.
Care.
Good talking to you. Hey, we'll be right back with the last segment of the Mike Malloy Show here on NoVam Radio. We've got Kirsten Holden and Orphan Watson. Another caller coming right in. We'll get to both of you on the other side. Hang on.
take a look around, and I'm underwhelmed with my big bad self. I'm a wild. So are you.
We're back, the Mike Malloy Show, right here on the Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Ferris. Going back to the phones. First up is Kirsten in Aberdeen, Washington. Welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, Jeff. I wasn't expecting you. It surprised me.
Wait a minute. You called me.
I know. I thought, well, I'm going to listen to the music a little longer. Jude called me from Seattle to let me know that she had heard a guest call in and mention the word coup.
Yes.
And that he had wondered if indeed we were in one.
If you go back to 2000 and the stolen election, you could certainly make that argument.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what I'm calling about. I really think the apex of that, although it was one of many apexes that they are still working on, mm-hmm. The apex of that came with the Military Commissions Act.
Right.
And if people had ever wondered when it was time to hit the streets and peacefully demonstrate, that was the time. And we can lie to ourselves just so long. There's a line from one of my poems, no truth binds, but would tumultuously thy freedom bring. Hmm. So face the truth and get busy. It's yep. just so simple. The hour is getting late, and it was a year ago that I began saying to my friends, this is a coup. Mm-hmm. It's obvious to me. And even dear Kurt Vonnegut, before his passing, said that this is a coup, as has another, Gore Vidal.
Right, yeah.
Gore Vidal, God bless him.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like people to be calm and to identify what's going on, because it is one, and they're enjoying every second of it because it's so in our face. And if they
yeah.
were to...
It's interesting. I think Bill Clinton at one point, they asked him about, you know, if this was some sort of conspiracy. He goes, you know, it's not a conspiracy because it's right out in the open.
Exactly. You know? And that's half of the joy that they get from it.
Right, yep.
So that's all I have to say, besides the fact that you're a great substitute for Mike. Thank you for how nice you are.
Very kind of you, Kirsten. I appreciate that.
Thank you. And have a great evening.
You too.
Bye.
Bye. Next up is Bob from Parts Unknown. Bob, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Is this Jeff?
Yes, it is.
Oh, hey. Well, I listen to your show every day, and I normally can't call you because I'm at work, and mm-hmm. I can't be, you know, screwing off like that. All I can do is just listen.
Thank you.
I guess what I wanted to call about is I'm hearing, you know, everybody's big news thing is federal prosecutor dismissals and things like that.
Right. Nine of them up to today, yeah.
Yeah, well, it seems like nobody's talking about the two that were murdered and everything. And that's kind of surprising, and that's pretty well-buried news.
Well, who are the two that were killed?
They were Dallas investigators, and they were investigating a major Medicare fraud case. It involved some very big names. Well, the first one... major name that's mentioned, okay, I stumbled across this whole thing by accident. I was looking, I heard about French elections,
mm-hmm.
and that there were some discrepancies there as far as, you know, the guy that just won was elected the same way Bush was here by, election fraud, you know,
vote
flipping, mm-hmm. and there's riots going on in Paris. So I typed in the keyword search, was it election fraud, France, those three words,
mm-hmm.
and I stumbled across this thing by accident. Looking for that, and has found out that these two attorneys in Texas, Dallas, Texas, that were investigating Medicare fraud, mysteriously died, supposedly of natural causes, within weeks of each other, and they were both working on the same case.
Wow.
It involved I'm not sure if this is the right name, Novartis, but it starts with N-O-V-A something.
Yeah, Novartis is a major healthcare company, yeah.
Well, they're a major supplier. Mm-hmm. They're like supply everything a hospital needs,
right.
and they got the lock on like better than half the business in America. So anyway, that's the thing that was mentioned in this guy's article, and he mentioned that the thing was suspicious causes, you know, and everything. But the thing, well, here's the deal: these two federal prosecutors die, and supposedly of natural causes. Yet the thing is, all evidence of their existence and history has been erased from the records. There's like, it's very hard to track down anything about them. You will not find any press releases or obituaries from any major news source. So here's the kicker. Beside the company cited as Novo something, whatever they are, they're a privately held company. You cannot get any details about their profits. But also, who was being prosecuted or subpoenaed for records with as a co-conspirator was General Electric and all the major drug companies. Now we're talking about some major financial muscle.
Yep, and some major connected muscle as well.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Wow.
And as far as board of directors and connections, the Bush family is connected, and Alberto Gonzalez is connected as law firms representing the Nova, whatever the outfit is.
Mm-hmm.
So they're connected to the case. And these two attorneys died, and there's not a peep about it in the mainstream press. What I'm finding on the Internet to confirm this story is, like, how do you say, secondary kind of websites, you know, mm-hmm. like these little, how do you say, labor of love websites
right,
and things
right.
like that, or business websites. But I'm not finding Reuters, Associated Press, or nothing like that. So you're talking about some major muscle that can make news like this just disappear as if these people never existed.
Right.
Yep, there's enough evidence about that they did.
Hey, Bob, send me jeff@jefferius.com. Send me some of that stuff that you're digging up, okay? Some links and stuff, all right?
Okay, well, I'll give you the main website where I found this article to start with.
Okay.
Well, type in, you'll find the same article.
Okay,
what do you call it? Election Fraud France and Tom Foco or something like that.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Bob.
All right, bye-bye.
All right. And so concludes another episode of the Mike Malloy Program here on Nova M Radio Network. I'm Jeff Ferris. I'll be back. My guest will be Mikey Weinstein tomorrow. I'm sure you've heard of him. We should have a fascinating conversation. Thanks to Ian Huff. All the magic you heard tonight came through his nimble fingers. Thanks to all the hardworking people here at Nova M Radio. Thanks to everyone who called to participate in the program today. Thanks to everyone who listened. Thanks to my buddy Sarge for his spiritual advice and emotional support. And thanks to Leslie Blitzer for all the fine clips. Be back tomorrow.